all filled my head. After a few minutes, I leaned against the bedroom door to better hear what the commotion was all about. I discovered that Jody and Vera were not yelling about me, but about some girl. I opened the door and sneaked down the stairs to the older boy's room. All at once, every head snapped up in my direction. Their faces were long and withdrawn. They all seemed busy, their bodies bent over as they stuffed their clothes and other belongings into brown bags and pillowcases. I knew, but I had to ask. "What's wrong? What's going on?" The oldest kid, Bobby, stated, "They're shutting down the house. You better pack whatever you got, 'cause tomorrow we're out of here." My mouth hung open. "Why? What's wrong?" No one answered. I ran to the bottom of the stairs and tugged on Bobby's shirt. As he looked down at me, I could tell by his eyes that he had been crying. I didn't know that older kids did that. Bobby shook his head. "Jody's been accused of statutory rape."
What?
I asked. "Hey, little dude, the word is that the Joneses took in this girl a few months back, and this chick now says she was raped, even though Jody was never alone in the house with her. If you ask me, I know it's all a lie. That chick was crazy," Bobby said. "Just go pack your stuff, and don't forget to check the laundry basket. Now scram." It only took me a minute to repack my things. As I stuffed my grocery bag, I turned off any feelings of sorrow I had for the Joneses. They were nice people, and I felt sorry for Jody and Vera, but my worldly possessions came first. To me, it was a matter of survival. The next morning, a fleet of cars arrived, and one by one the other foster children and I said our goodbyes. I kissed Vera on the cheek and hugged Jody's jolly tummy. As the social worker drove me down the hills, then past my school, I took out my sheet of addresses and scratched the Joneses from my list. I had stayed at their home for just over 2 months, my third foster home in half a year. The social worker informed me that some of the other foster kids I had lived with would end up in juvenile hall because there were no homes available. He went on to explain that Gordon couldn't pick me up because he had called in sick. But the social worker smiled. Gordon had given him a lead to a foster home that might take me in for a few days. I slumped in my seat and nodded my head. "Yeah, yeah," I said to myself. "How many times have I heard that before?" A couple of hours later, I burst from the county car and into Alice Turnbow's living room. I hugged Alice with all my heart. Moments later, the social worker knocked on the screen before entering. "You two know each other?" he asked in a weary tone. My head rattled up and down like a puppy dog. "Mrs. Turnbow, I know it's kind of short notice, but we had a situation. Can we place David here for a while?" he pleaded.
"Well, I really don't have the room, and I can't have him sharing a room with the girls. Is there any other—" My heart ached. I wanted to stay with Alice so badly. My eyes began to water as I looked up at the social worker, who hesitated for a moment. I then turned to Alice, who seemed to act the same. Alice shook her head. "I don't think it's right for David. I mean—"
A long stretch of silence followed. I let go of Alice and gazed at the carpet.
"Well," Alice said in a defeated tone, "can you at least tell me how long you expect him to stay? I guess I can put him back on the couch. That is, if you don't mind too much, David."
I clamped my eyes shut for the longest time. My head swam with a stream of endless thoughts. I didn't care. I didn't care whether I slept on a couch or a bed of nails. I just wanted to stay at a place that I could call home.
Chapter 9. Coming Around.
My stay with the Turnbows was day by day. The days turned into weeks, with still no word of where I would end up. Out of frustration, Alice re-enrolled me into Parkside Junior High. As happy as I was to return to school to see my teachers again, I still felt a dark cloud over me. I dreaded walking to Alice's home after school. I'd peek around the corner looking for a county car, knowing I'd soon be driven off. Every day, out of fear, I'd bug Alice in my desperate effort to find out any news from Gordon Hutchinson. I just wanted to know. As the weeks turned into months, I found myself still sleeping on the couch and living out of a grocery bag. My clothes became weathered and moldy because I only washed them on Saturday afternoon after 3 p.m., or on Sunday. I knew that those were the only times I was safe from being moved. After forgetting my pet turtle at the Catanzas, I didn't want to take the chance of losing anything else again. Every night after everyone had gone to bed, I would pray on the couch that tomorrow Gordon would decide my fate. One day, when I returned to Alice's home after school, she sat me down. I swallowed hard as I braced myself for the bad news, but no word had come. Alice informed me of something else. I would be seeing a psychiatrist tomorrow. I shook my head no. Alice went on to explain that she understood the problems about my former doctor. I was surprised that she knew so much about my past when I hadn't told her anything. "So you've been talking to my probation officer? And he still hasn't seen me?" I asked, feeling exposed and ashamed. Alice explained that she was working on a plan to have me placed with her, but it would take time to receive a license to have boys in her home. "But not to worry," she stated. "Harold and I have decided that we'd like you to stay with us for a while." Without hesitating, I gave Alice a kiss. Then I thought about her last statement and gave her a frown. "You mean Harold wants me to stay, too?" Alice laughed. "Just because Harold doesn't talk that much to you doesn't mean he doesn't like you. He just has a hard time understanding you. Frankly, I'm sure a lot of people would. But take my word, if Harold didn't want you, you wouldn't be here." Her big hands wrapped around my skinny fingers. "Oh, Leo likes you more than you know." Alice's explanation of Harold meant the world to me. Ever since I had blurted out to him about sharing a room with a girl, I felt Harold thought of me as a weird kid. He never seemed to talk to me. Whenever he did utter a few words in my direction, he'd try to get me to read rather than watch television. Every night after dinner, like clockwork, Harold would always pull out an old Western paperback and smoke his Camel cigarettes before going to bed precisely at 9 p.m. I respected Harold so much, although he never knew. As a carpenter, he had a passion for his craft. I hoped I could stay with the Turnbows long enough for Harold to teach me a few things. Ever since I was a small child, I had fantasized about building a log cabin at the Russian River, so at times I had imagined Harold and me working on a project together in hopes of bringing us closer. Maybe, I thought, by then I could prove myself to him. The next day, after much prodding from Alice, I hopped on a bus and went to meet my new psychiatrist, Dr. Robertson, who turned out to be the complete opposite of the great doctor I had before. He greeted me with a handshake and told me to call him by his first name, Donald. His entire office was bathed in bright, warm sunshine, but the thing that meant the most to me was that Dr. Robertson treated me like a person. On my weekly visits to Dr. Robertson, I never felt forced to talk about anything, but soon found myself initiating the conversation about my past. I questioned Dr. Robertson about everything, including whether I was doomed to follow in my mother's footsteps. Dr. Robertson always tried to steer me in another direction, but I fought to maintain my lifelong course of finding my answers. I learned to trust him as he gently led me through the maze of the sensitive parts of my past. Because of my persistence, Dr. Robertson suggested some books for me to study on basic psychology. Soon afterward, Harold and I seemed to bicker about who was hogging the lamp by the end of the couch, as I tried to read books on self-esteem by Norman Vincent Peale or others on the stranger side, such as Your Erroneous Zones. I found myself intrigued with the basic theories of survival traits, as written by Dr. Abraham Maslow. At times I'd become frustrated with the big words, but I hung tough and soon discovered it had taken a lot just for me to make it as far as I had. Although on the inside, parts of me still felt awkward and hollow, I realized I was stronger than most of the kids at school, who seemed to live in a normal world. At Alice's home, I found myself opening up to her about everything, all the time. Sometimes she and I would gab far into the early morning hours. I never worried about how I talked or what I said. Whenever I became nervous and began to stutter, Alice would teach me how to slow down my train of thought and have me picture myself saying the words before I spoke them. Within a few weeks, my speech problem disappeared. Every Saturday afternoon, after Alice danced her usual jig to American Bandstand, she and I would venture past the railroad tracks on our way to the same mall where Mrs. Catanza had taken me shopping for my clothes. We always saw a movie, and that was the only way Alice could get me to sit still for any length of time. As I sat quietly beside her, I'd wring my hands as I scrutinized every scene. My mind raced to stay one step ahead of the sometimes mindless plot. I became fascinated by complicated screenplays and how the director pieced everything together. After every show, Alice and I went back and forth with our own critiques. Other times, for no special reason, she would buy me toys just because. At first I felt awkward and unworthy, partly because I wasn't used to receiving presents, and also because I knew how hard Harold worked and how he saved every penny. In time, I learned to accept presents. For me, that was a very hard lesson to swallow. The most important gift the Turnbows gave me was my one last chance at being a kid, while preparing me for my life as an adult. In an effort to show Alice and Harold how much they meant to me, one afternoon at the kitchen table, the famed table of talk, I plucked a soiled piece of torn paper from my pant pocket and ripped it into tiny fragments.
"Now, what's that all about?" Harold scowled as tears rolled down Alice's cheeks.
"I don't need it anymore," I boasted. "And I know your phone number, too. Want to hear?"
Alice nodded her head yes.
"It's 555-2647,
I proudly stated as I looked straight into Harold's blue eyes.
"Well, maybe now's the time to get that unlisted phone number," he grumbled before winking at me.
Whenever Alice and I talked for any great length of time, the subject of my future always came up. Even the simple question, "What do you want to do when you grow up, David?" caused me to become scared from the bottom of my soul. I always seemed to picture Chris, the foster kid from the Catanzas home, and how frightened he was to turn 18. I had never thought that far ahead. In order to survive against mother's torture, I only had to plan hour by hour, or day by day at the most. Being alone in the wide open world was the most frightening thing I could ever possibly imagine. I'd become so scared and tense that I'd begin to stutter again. Alice always seemed to calm me down, but at night, when I finally had a room of my own to sleep in, I'd shiver with fear at the thought of how I was going to buy food or where I would live. I would think so hard that I'd fall asleep with an enormous headache. For me, at age 15, the countdown began. Soon after the initial shock wore off, I decided to find ways to make money. I started out by shining shoes, and my first day out I earned $21, polishing dozens of shoes in just under 6 hours. I felt so proud as I juggled my shoe shine kit and a box of donuts in one hand and a bouquet of flowers for Alice and a couple of paperback books for Harold in the other. I soon added a job at a watch repair shop, where I worked about 20 hours a week for $10.25 take-home pay. The amount of money wasn't important to me. At the end of the work week, I'd fall asleep feeling I'd accomplished something. And that was what was important. While the other kids played street ball or hung around the mall, I was becoming self-sufficient. It was very difficult for me to find anything I had in common with the other kids at school. Most of them fought to impress others by acting cool. I knew that on the outside, I didn't fit in, so I simply gave up trying. At times I played the role of class clown, but for the most part I didn't care what my classmates thought of me. Whenever they bragged about their weekend ski trips, I'd think about how I could squeeze in an extra hour of work. One Friday, a few weeks before I graduated from Parkside Junior High, a group of rich kids were bragging about their upcoming graduation and plans of going to Disneyland or traveling to Hawaii first class. Instead of feeling sorry for myself, I ran from the bus stop that afternoon and nearly knocked down the screen door to Alice's home. "What is it?" she shrieked. I gulped down a glass of water before answering. I was pushing 16 and didn't know how to cook for myself. Alice assured me that she would teach me when the time came. I persisted. I wanted to learn how to cook now. I gave her one of my serious looks, the kind I had learned from Mrs. Catanza, who always placed her hands on her hips. It worked. Even though Alice had just cleaned her home for the bridge party, which would be held in just a couple of hours, she decided to teach me how to make pancakes. Alice's decision was her undoing. In a matter of minutes, I went through 2 boxes of Bisquick pancake mix, 4 dozen eggs, and 2 gallons of milk. Every square inch of the gas stove was covered with the thick, white, gooey mix, and the ceiling was splattered with a few well-intended tossed pancakes. The floor looked as if a blizzard had blown through, and every time Alice or I shuffled across it, we nearly suffocated from the clouds of white powder. The strain on her face was quite visible, but she laughed with me, and I didn't quit until I made the perfect pancake. Every day seemed to hold a new adventure. Sometimes after school I'd play on the living room floor with my Legos or my Erector set, while other times I was the little big man returning to Alice's home after school just long enough to change clothes before zipping off to work at one of my jobs. For the first time, I had a real life. By July of 1976, my life took another turn. I grew tired of riding my bike to work every morning while everyone else was still fast asleep. Then one afternoon, after a frustrating day on the job, I returned from work to find that not one, but 2 older foster boys had moved in. I took an instant dislike to one of the boys, Bruce, partly because I had to share a room with him, and partly because I knew he got away with conning Alice blind. Even though both boys were 17, they didn't seem too concerned about supporting themselves. I began to resent them both. Whenever I pedaled off to work, they spent the day at the mall with Alice. In an odd sense, I felt threatened and violated by their presence. I knew my childlike times with Alice were over, but I just wanted to hang on a little bit longer before I had to grow up. After a few weeks, I discovered that my stash of money and some of the things I had bought through my earnings were missing. At first I thought I had misplaced my items, but one day, for no special reason, I had had enough. I marched up to Alice and demanded that either they leave or I would. I knew I sounded like a spoiled brat, but I could no longer tolerate trying to hide my things all the time, wondering at work how to make up for the stolen money. Everything I had worked so hard for slowly disappeared. I hoped Alice would give in, but I soon found myself packing. I felt like a complete fool leaving the Turnbows. To me, it was a matter of honor. If I said something, I had to be responsible for my word. I stayed at Juvenile Hall for a few weeks until my new probation officer, Mrs. O'Ryan, placed me with John and Linda Walsh, a young couple in their 20s who had 3 kids. John had long black hair and played piano in a rock and roll band, while Linda was a beauty consultant at the local Walgreens drugstore. They were both very nice, and I was extremely surprised by their carefree attitude. They pretty much allowed me to do as I pleased. When I wanted to buy a mini bike, John said yes. One day when I timidly asked John if he could drive me to the local sports shop so I could buy a BB gun, he replied, "Let's go." I was stunned. I would never have even thought of asking Mr. or Mrs. Turnbow, but John didn't even blink. His only condition was that he had to teach me gun safety, and I could only shoot against paper targets under his supervision. I soon forgot about looking for another job and developed the Walsh's laid-back attitude. A few weeks into my freshman year in high school, John and Linda told me that they were moving. Without thinking, I huffed into the room I shared with their 2-year-old boy and crammed everything I owned into a pillowcase. I was livid. It seemed that every time I adjusted to a new environment, something happened. I realized that John and Linda seemed to fight all the time, but I got used to that as well as having to babysit their bratty kids. With my belongings slung over my shoulder, I marched back into the living room. "All right," I demanded. "Let's go. Take me to the hill." John and Linda both looked at each other and laughed. "No, man," John said, as he waved his hand in front of his face. "I said we're moving, and you're coming with us. That is, if you don't have a problem with that." I became so upset at myself. So I stood in front of them and stewed for several minutes, until I smiled and said, "I don't know what you two are laughing at, but I'm already packed. What about you?" Linda jabbed John in the gut. "Smart kid." The next day I stood in the back of an oversized U-Haul while John drove to the edge of the county. When he finally stopped, I leaped from the trailer. I couldn't believe what I saw. It was as if the Walshes and I had moved into the Leave It to Beaver neighborhood. I stepped around the U-Haul and gawked at the entire block. Every lawn was perfectly manicured. The immaculate houses looked more like miniature mansions than ordinary homes, and every car in its driveway had a blinding shine, as if it had just been waxed. As I strolled down the middle of Dunsmore Drive, I breathed in the sweet smell of flowers, and I could hear the sound of the wind fluttering through a giant weeping willow. I shook my head and smiled and sighed. "Yes," I shouted. "I could live here." In no time at all, I made friends with Paul Brazell and Dave Howard, 2 neighborhood teenagers who seemed fascinated by my dark, rusty red minibike and my Daisy BB gun. Their eyes seemed hungry for adventure. I was more than happy to feed them. I discovered Paul had a minibike too, and soon the 3 of us held drag races in the middle of the lifeless street. Paul always won for 3 reasons. His minibike had more horsepower than mine, he weighed less than I did, and he had brakes, allowing him to slow down long after I did. Out of the hundreds of races, I won only 1. That day my throttle became stuck. I wasn't worried since I had a cutoff switch, which I immediately discovered wouldn't shut off the engine. Since I didn't have any brakes, I tried to slow down by dragging my feet. As I did, my shoes slipped and the bottom of my shirt became caught in the rear sprocket. For a moment, I had one hand on the throttle, while the rest of my body flailed before being dragged down the middle of the street. I was too scared to let go. I finally released my grip, and a split second later my minibike jumped the sidewalk, flying up and over a bush. Just in front of me, Dave hit the ground, rolling with laughter. Seconds later, Paul pulled up. His eyes were as big as silver dollars. "Man, that was too cool! Can you do that again?" As I struggled to stand up, I could see some of the adults from the neighborhood staring in our direction. They seemed more concerned over the damage to the bush than my medical condition. Trying to forget the unfriendly looks, I blocked out the pain and gave Paul my widest smile. From that moment on, I was dubbed the Stuntmaster of Dunsmore. That evening, the three of us plotted our next adventure. Paul's parents had a 16mm camera, so Paul decided to make a James Bond-style movie, casting me as the lead actor. The climax of the film was to have Dr. Strange, played by Dave, drag Bond up and down the street while Paul filmed from all angles. I told Paul I wasn't so sure about the stunt, while Dave panted like a dog, claiming he wouldn't mind watching my knees turn into hamburger. Dave doubled as my stunt coordinator, which entailed keeping the street clear of all traffic under the age of 10, and having a set of band-aids at the ready whenever my gag was completed. I was thankful the next day when Paul's camera ran out of film, before my death-defying climax. One day, Paul helped me prepare to meet a girl from around the block. I had never talked to a girl before, but Paul loaned me his best shirt and coached me on what to say. At that time in my life, I was barely looking at myself in the mirror, let alone having the confidence to talk to a girl. After combing my hair, hearing more coaching, and having no more excuses, I let Paul kick me out of his house, and I strolled down Dunsmore. As I turned the corner, I felt like a normal person. I lived in a perfect neighborhood. My foster parents let me do as I wished. I didn't have to work, and most important, my life was centered around the best friends in the entire world. Minutes later, I rapped on the front door and waited. My hands shook, and I felt lightheaded as sweat seemed to escape from every pore of my body. I was actually excited to be a little frightened. This was a good scare. I began to rub my hands when the door opened. I thought my mouth would fall to the floor. I felt tingly all over as I stared into the face of the prettiest girl I had ever seen. Without the girl knowing, I regained my composure as she began to talk. The more she spoke, the better I felt about myself. I couldn't believe how easy it was to make the girl laugh. I was enjoying myself, right up until the moment when the girl's mother pushed her aside. It took a moment for my eyes to adjust. When they did, I looked up at a woman who looked more like the lady from the Brady Bunch than someone's mother. The woman quickly jabbed a finger in my face. "You're that little F-child, aren't you?" she sneered with a tight smirk on her face. I was too stunned to speak. "Have you no respect for elders? Answer me, boy." "Ma'am?" I said, shaking my head. "Listen to me," the woman raved. "I know all about you and those motorcycles, making all that reverberating noise and the willful destruction of private property. How did the association ever approve of your kind of people residing in our neighborhood? I know all about your kind. You're a filthy little hooligan. Just look at your attire. You reek of street trash. I don't know what you children do to become fostered children," she said, covering her mouth as if she had just spoken a swear word. "But I'm sure you did something hideous, didn't you?" The woman's face turned so red that I thought she was going to explode.
Don't you dare approach my household or converse with my children ever. I stood mesmerized by the woman's perfectly manicured red fingernail in my face. And just a piece of advice, the woman went on. Don't waste your time trying. You don't have what it takes to make it. I know. Believe me. I'm actually doing you a favor. She smiled as she tossed her hair to the other side of her face. You'll see. I'm a very open-minded person who knows a thing or two. So the sooner you learn that you're only an F-child, the better off you'll be. So stick with your own kind. Before I could respond, the front door slammed shut with such a fury that I felt a rush of air hit my face. I stood by the door, dumbstruck. I didn't know what to do. I felt as if I were an inch tall. I gazed at the sleeves of Paul's red and black flannel shirt. They were a little short, but I thought the shirt looked nice. I ran my hand through my oily hair. I guess I could use a bath, I muttered to myself. I knew that on the outside I was a walking geek, but on the inside I felt better about myself than ever before. I tried so hard to do things that normal kids took for granted. I just wanted to fit in. I wanted to be like a normal kid. Minutes later, with my head hung low, I passed Paul, who danced around me as he pestered me with questions about meeting the girl. I waved off my best friend and hid in my room for the rest of the day. The next afternoon, while I was tinkering with my mini-bike, a tall man walked up to me with a beer can in one hand and a baby stroller in the other. "So, you're the neighborhood threat," he said with a sly grin. I kept my head down as I felt my body temperature begin to rise. Before I could mouth off, the man breezed on by. About half an hour later, the man reappeared in the opposite direction. I waited for another put-down, but this time I was ready to fire off an insult. He gave me a wide smile before saying, "Good on you, boy. Get some." I shook my head, thinking my ears were clogged. "Good on me? Get some? Get some what?" I asked myself. I stood up, wiped a spot of black oil onto my dirty white tank top, and watched the man as he bobbed past me to the driveway next door. He gave me another nod before disappearing into the garage. I was so stunned that I sat down on the grass and thought about what the crazy man meant. As demented as he seemed, he did have a way with words. The next afternoon, at the same time, the man reappeared in the same outfit, a pair of white shorts that showed off his ash-white bony knees, an undersized T-shirt that read, "Fudpuckers, we've been flying since the world's been square," a baseball cap with silver-winged feathers pinned in the middle, and a cigarette that seemed to dangle from his bottom lip. Again, with a beer in one hand and a baby stroller in the other, he stopped in front of me and winked. "Airborne material you're not, but don't worry, Slim, every dog has his day." And he pushed on. I repeated his message over and over again as I tried to find a meaning to the phrase, "Every dog has his day." Just like clockwork, the man returned 30 minutes later. I jumped up and waited for his eloquent words of wisdom. "Know this," the man said with a bow, "there's always profit in mass confusion." "Hey, mister," I said before I could think. The man's head spun around like a top. "You inquired?" My mouth hung open. I didn't know how to respond. I could feel myself choke up. He bowed his head. "If you can wash your hands and change your attire, you may join me at my humble abode." In a flash, I raced through the Walsh's house, scrubbed my arms and hands, dirtying their bathroom sink, and changed my shirt before bursting through the man's front door. Before I could yell my presence, a giant hand slapped me in the center of my chest. I lost my breath and thought my chest would cave in.
The man looked down and smiled.
"Let's try that again, shall we?" he said as he led me out the front door and closed it in my face. I frowned to myself. "How rude," I said out loud. For a moment I thought I was being put down the way the Brady Bunch lady had done.
I was about to leave when I heard a muffled voice from behind the door state,
"Knock on the door."
I rolled my eyes as my knuckles rapped on the front door. A moment later the door flung open, and the man bowed at the waist as he waved his arm, permitting me to enter. He smiled as he introduced himself.
"Michael Marsh, Keeper of the Faith, Soldier of Fortune, and the Doc Savage of Dunsmore Drive."
And so began my first of many visits to Marsh Manor. Days later I met Mr. Marsh's wife, Sandra, who was quiet and shy compared with her peculiar husband. I was instantly taken with their two boys, William and Eric. Watching their toddler Eric dribble as he crawled around the house reminded me of my brother Kevin when he was that age. The Marshes treated me like a real person. While the Walshes argued more than ever, the Marshes' home became my safe haven. Whenever I wasn't promoting chaos with Paul and Dave, I spent hundreds of hours sitting in a corner of Michael's famed Hall of Knowledge, reading books about movies, race cars, and airplanes. Ever since I was a prisoner in Mother's house, I developed a fascination for aircraft. The many times I would sit on top of my hands in the bottom of the cold garage, I'd escape by fantasizing I was Superman. I always wanted to fly. Although I was never allowed to take any of Mr. Marsh's books to the Walsh's home, I'd sometimes sneak off with a book and stay up all night, reading about the real-life adventures of World War II fighter pilots or the development of specialized aircraft like the Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird. Michael's library opened up a whole new world to me. For the first time in my life, I began to wonder what it would be like to fly aboard a real airplane. Maybe, I thought, one of these days. Paul's father, Dan Brazell, was the Mr. Goodwrench of the neighborhood, and he had the same effect on me as Mr. Marsh. At first, Mr. Brazell was wary of me, but eventually he grew to tolerate my standing over his shoulder, quizzing his every movement. Sometimes Paul, Dave, and I would peek into Mr. Brazell's garage and stare in awe at whatever projects he was building from scratch. Whenever he left the garage for a few minutes, Paul would strut in while Dave and I followed in Paul's footsteps for fear of disturbing a piece of metal or a placed tool. However, as soon as the door opened, the three of us would scurry out of the garage before Dan caught us. We knew that the garage was a special domain where Dan, Michael, and a host of other men from the neighborhood gathered for their daily meetings. Sometimes during the daily gatherings, a few of the men from the neighborhood frowned at me as they complained about the fear of plummeting real estate values in the local area. Mr. Marsh always came to my rescue.
"Back off, boys," Michael once warned.
"I have plans for my young ward. I predict that Mr. Peltzer here will become the next Chuck Yeager or Charles Manson. As you can see, I'm still working on the details." I smiled at the compliment. "Yeah," I nodded in defiance. "Charles Manson." I did feel a little foolish that I didn't recall Charles Manson as an ace fighter pilot. My times at Dunsmore were the best in my teenage life. At night, after reading one of Mr. Marsh's borrowed books, I'd fall asleep to the scent of flowers from a soft outside breeze. Every day after school carried a new adventure, waiting for my two friends and me to discover. My stay at the Walsh's was not so good. Raging arguments were a daily occurrence, and at times both of them would storm out of the house, leaving me to watch their children. Sometimes I'd try to time the fights, so that before John and Linda began to hit each other, I could grab the youngest child and order the other two children to follow me outside until things calmed down.
As much as I loved Dunsmore, I knew I couldn't keep living like I did. I felt that I had to do something. Finally, after an explosive argument, I called Mrs. O'Ryan, my probation officer, and begged her to move me, even if it meant returning to the hill. Mrs. O'Ryan seemed pleased with my decision, and thought she could convince the Turnbows to take me back. Leaving Dunsmore was one of the hardest decisions I had to make. In a matter of months, in the tiniest fraction of my life, Dunsmore had given me so much. I made it a point not to say goodbye. Paul, Dave, and I seemed choked up, but we hid our feelings behind our age. At the last moment, Dave gave me a hug. Mr. Brazell saluted me while holding a wrench, while Mr. Marsh presented me with a book on airplanes, the same book I had sneaked out of his house dozens of times.
"This way you won't have to break in my house, you hooligan."
He also gave me an autographed Delta Airline postcard. On it he scrawled his address and phone number.
"Stay in touch, Slim," Michael said as I felt myself beginning to get emotional. "Day or night, Sandra and I are here for you. Hang tough, Airborne. Get some."
Before climbing into Harold Turnbow's ancient blue-and-white Chevy pickup, I cleared my throat, then announced in my Michael Marsh-like voice,
"Shed no tears, have no fear, for I shall return."
As Mr. Turnbow and I motored away from Dunsmore Drive, I saw the Brady Bunch woman, who stood on her immaculate front porch with her arms tightly across her chest. She gave me a sneering smile. I smiled back before shouting,
"Love you too!"
Almost an hour later, I burst through Alice Turnbow's screen door. After a quick hug, she pushed me away. "This is the last time," she warned. "Speak now or forever hold your peace." I nodded before replying. "I know where I belong. 555-2647. Chapter 10. Breakaway. During the middle of my sophomore year in high school, I grew frustrated and bored. Because I had moved so much and never stayed in one school for more than a few months at a time, I was placed in a class for slow learners. I fought the idea at first until I discovered that very little was expected of me. By then I abandoned all of my academic studies, for I knew my future lay outside the school walls. I was putting in over 48 hours of work a week, through a string of jobs, and I believed that nothing I learned from high school could be used in the real world. My hunger for work was fueled by the fact that I was 17 and had less than a year to go in foster care. During sixth period, I'd race from school to Alice's home, change clothes, then speed off again to one of my jobs at a fast food restaurant or the plastic factory, where I worked until 1 or 2 in the morning. I knew that the odd hours and lack of sleep were taking their toll on me. In school, teachers had to prod me awake as I snored in their classes. I resented the kids who laughed at me. Some of these same kids acted high and mighty whenever they saw me labor at the restaurants, strutting in to show off their dates or flashy clothes, knowing they would never have to work like I did in order to survive. Sometimes, during my free period, I'd stroll over to visit my English teacher, Mr. Tapley. Since he didn't have class that period, Mr. Tapley used his time to correct papers. I'd plant my elbows on his desk and bug him with an endless stream of questions about my future. He knew how hard I struggled, but I was too embarrassed to tell him why I would always fall asleep. Mr. Tapley would look up from his pile of work, run a hand through his thinning hair, and feed me just enough advice to get me through the weekend, to bury myself in my homework assignments. As much as I labored through the week, I tried to schedule every other weekend off, on the off chance of visiting Father in San Francisco. Over the years, I had left hundreds of messages to all the fire stations throughout the city. Father never called back. One afternoon, I lost it when a hesitant fireman tried to put me off. "Is this the right station?" I pleaded. "Just tell me, what shift does he work?" I begged, raising my voice.
Stephen works at different stations at different times. We'll get the message to him," the fireman said before the line went dead. I knew something was horribly wrong. Alice tried to stop me from fleeing her home. "My dad's in trouble," I shouted, my chest heaving.
"David, you don't know that," Alice blasted back.
"That's exactly what I mean," I said, pointing a finger at her. "I'm tired of living in the dark, of hiding secrets, of living a lie. What can be so bad? If my dad's in trouble..."
I stopped for a moment as my imagination began to take hold.
"I just have to know,"
I said, kissing Alice on the forehead.
I hopped on my motorcycle and sped off to the heart of San Francisco. On the freeway, I dodged and swerved through the traffic, and I didn't slow down until my motorcycle rumbled into the alley next to 1067 Post Street, the same fire station Father had been assigned to since I was a baby. I parked my motorcycle by the back entrance of the station. As I walked up the steep incline, I noticed an old familiar face. At first I thought the face belonged to Father, but I knew it wasn't him when the face smiled. Father never smiled.
"My Lord, son, how long has it been? I haven't seen you boys in... I don't know how long."
I shook hands with Uncle Lee, my father's longtime partner and best friend.
"Where's Dad?"
I asked in a stern voice.
Uncle Lee turned away.
"Well, he just left. He just went off shift."
"No, sir," I demanded.
I knew Uncle Lee was lying. Firemen changed shifts in the morning, not in the middle of the afternoon. I lowered my defenses.
"Uncle Lee, I haven't seen Dad in years. I have to know."
Lee seemed choked up. He rubbed a tear from the corner of his eye.
"Your father and I started out together, you know. I gotta tell you, your old man was one hell of a fireman. There were times when I thought we wouldn't make it."
I could feel it coming. My insides became unglued. My eyes searched for something to grab onto, to keep me from falling. I bit my lip. I nodded my head as if telling Uncle Lee to just let it out and tell me.
Lee's eyes blinked, showing that he understood.
"Your father doesn't work for the department anymore. Stephen, your father was asked to retire early."
I let out a sigh of relief as I fought to control my feelings. "So he's alive. He's okay. Where is he?" I shrieked.
Uncle Lee laid it all down, telling me that Father hadn't had work for over a year. So when his money ran out, he moved from place to place, and at times Lee feared that Father slept on the street.
"David, it's the booze. It's killing him,"
he said in a soft but firm tone.
"So where is he now?" I begged.
"I don't know, son. I only see him when he needs a few bucks."
Uncle Lee stopped for a moment to clear his throat. He looked at me in a way he never had before.
"David, don't be too hard on your old man. He never really had a family. He was a young man when he first came here to the city. He loved you kids, but the marriage destroyed him. His job wasn't easy on him either. It's all that kept him going. He lived for the station, but his drinking, it's all that he knows."
"Thanks, Uncle Lee," I said as I shook his hand. "Thanks for not putting me off. At least now I know."
Uncle Lee walked me down to my motorcycle.
"I should see your dad in a few days. Hell, maybe you can help him out of this mess."
"Yeah," I replied. "Maybe."
2 weekends later, I rode on a Greyhound bus to the Mission District of San Francisco. At the bus station, I waited for Father for over an hour. From outside, I spotted a run-down bar. I took a chance, walked across the street and found Father slumped over on top of a table. My head swiveled around, searching for help.
I couldn't believe how people strolled by Father's table without the slightest concern, or sat by the bar nursing their drinks as if my father were invisible. I gently shook my childhood superhero from his slumber. Father's coughing seemed to awaken him. His stench was so bad that I held my breath until I could help him stumble from the bar. The outside air seemed to clear his head. In the sunlight, Father looked worse than I ever imagined. I deliberately didn't look at his face. I wanted to remember my father for the man he once was. The tall, rugged, strong firefighter with gleaming white teeth who placed himself in danger to help a fellow fireman or rescue a child from a burning building. Father and I walked for several blocks without saying a word. I knew better than to question him on his drinking or his lifestyle. But Uncle Lee's warning about doing something, anything, to help Father echoed in my mind. Without thinking, I closed my eyes, spun around, and held out my hand, stopping him. "What happened, Dad?" Father stopped and let out a hacking cough. His hands trembled as he struggled to light a cigarette.
"You'd be better off forgetting all about it. The whole thing. Your mother, the house, everything. It never happened."
Father took a deep drag. I tried to look into his eyes, but he kept dodging my glance.
"It's your mother. She's crazy. You'd be better off forgetting the whole thing,"
he ordered with a wave of his hand, as if sweeping the family secret under the carpet for the final time. "No, Dad. It's you. I'm worried about you." A chill blew across my face. My body shuddered and I clamped my eyes shut. I wanted to cry out to Father, and yet I didn't have the guts to tell him how much I was scared for him. My brain struggled with what was right and what was proper. I knew by Father's look that his life was his business, and that no one ever questioned a father's authority. But he was a walking death. His hands rattled every few seconds, and his eyelids were dropped so low that he could barely see. I felt so awkward. I didn't want to make Father mad, but I soon found myself becoming upset.
"Why weren't you there for me? Couldn't you have at least called me? Can't you be like a regular dad with a job and a family, so I could be with you and play catch or go fishing? Why can't you be normal?" my brain screamed.
I sucked in a deep breath before I opened my eyes.
"I'm sorry. It's just that you're my dad, and I love you."
Father wheezed as he turned away. I knew he had heard me, but he couldn't bring himself to reply. The river of alcohol and the destroyed family life had stripped him of his innermost feelings. I realized that inside, my father was truly dead. Moments later, he and I continued our journey to nowhere, with our heads bent down looking at no one, especially not ourselves. Hours later, before Father loaded me onto the bus, he pulled me aside.
"I want to show you something,"
he said with pride as he reached behind him and plucked out a black leather covering with the emblem of the fireman's shield on it. Father smiled as he opened the casing, revealing a bright, shiny silver fireman's badge.
"Here, hold it,"
he said as he gently placed the badge in my open palms.
R-1522, I read aloud, knowing that the R signified that Father was indeed retired, and not fired as I had feared, while the numbers were those assigned to Father when he first joined.
"That's all I have now. That's one of the only things in my life that I didn't screw up too badly. No one can ever take that away from me,"
he stated with conviction, pointing to his prize.
"Someday, you'll understand."
I nodded my head. I understood. I always had.
In the past, I had imagined Father dressed in his crisp, dark blue fireman's uniform, as he strolled to a podium to receive his badge of honor in front of a frenzied crowd shouting his name, with his beautiful wife and family standing by his side. As a child, I had dreamed of Father's big day. I now looked into his eyes as I gave him his lifetime achievement. "I'm really proud of you, Dad," I said, gazing down at the badge. "I truly am." For a split second, Father's eyes gleamed, and for a moment in time, his pain disappeared. A few minutes later, Father stopped me on the steps of the bus. He hesitated. His eyes looked down.
"Get out of here," he mumbled. "David, get as far away from here as you can. Your brother Ronald joined the service, and you're almost at that age. Get out,"
Father said as he patted my shoulder. As he turned away, his final words were,
"Do what you have to. Don't end up like me."
I pressed my face to the window of the bus and strained my eyes as I watched Father disappear into the crowd. I wanted to jump off and hug him, to hold his hand or sit by his side the way I did as a child whenever he read his evening paper, like the dad I knew so many years ago.